listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. The Vance's birth chart. With their marriage under a microscope, the second couple may find solace in the stars. With a little help from astrologically minded friends, Elise Taylor charts the course of their compatibility. Humans often use astrology, the ancient belief that the sun, moon, and planets influence our behaviors and life paths to explain the unexplainable, like why are we the way that we are? What is our purpose here on Earth? And what exactly the hell is going on with J.D. Vance and Usha Vance's marriage? What started as an admittedly dark online bit that the vice president seemed a little too close for comfort with Erica Kirk got a curveball catalyst when the second lady made a very public appearance alongside Melania Trump without her wedding ring. At the time, her spokesperson said Usha was a mother of three young children who does a lot of dishes, gives lots of baths, and forgets her ring sometimes. Coincidence? Almost certainly. But how many dishes does one do when living at No. 1 Observatory Circle, the vice president's official Queen Anne-style mansion that has dedicated staff quarters? Then there was that image circulating in the bowels of the internet that showed a man who looked exactly like J.D. scowling at an unidentifiable brunette woman in a restaurant. I always wear an undershirt when I go out in public to have a fight loudly with my wife, J.D. sarcastically posted on X about it. Then a plot twist. On January 20th, the couple announced they were expecting their fourth child. Anyway, back to astrology. With rumors swirling and statements slinging, we ask celebrity favorite astrologers Tali Adut and Ophira Adut, better known as the Astro Twins, to make sense of it all. J.D. is a Leo sun with Leo rising and Libra moon, a praise-hungry people-pleaser with an unquenchable thirst for power. Usha is a Capricorn sun with Cancer rising and Scorpio moon, a mother's sweet smile masking a deep well of secrets and an iron grip of control, the Adepts say. Yes, they do chart readings as a duo. So what do their charts have in common? Mars in Scorpio, a highly strategic astrological placement that operates best behind the scenes, they say. While J.D. fumbles in public, Usha calculates behind the scenes, making them quite the formidable duo to cross. Interesting. Now, how is Usha feeling about her husband's rise to power and her role in the chaotic Trump White House? Usha, as a Capricorn, is playing the long game. We have little doubt that she is leveraging his present-day power and relationships for the Vance family's fiscal security. With her Cancer rising, she will try to stay together for the children until their futures are secured. But this is not guaranteed. Once bloviating Jupiter arrives in Leo, J.D.'s sign, June 30, 2026 to July 26, 2027, the vice president's bluster and ego may inflate to a point that is no longer tolerable for her. Does that mean tension is in the stars? Right after President Donald Trump hosts a UFC match at the White House for America's 250th? Here's where it gets chilling, they say, with a dramatic pause. Their composite chart has seven placements in Scorpio, including the moon, personal planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, plus traditional Saturn, power-hungry Pluto, and the karmic South Node. This marriage is serious business with a bond that is hard to break. And if I had to learn this, you do too. There's strong sexual chemistry and an ability to generate vast wealth as a couple. It's not their first lifetime as a power pair, and it won't be their last. How's that for a state of the union? Familiar signs, three other Leo Capricorn couples and one could-be friendship, Barack Obama, Leo, and Michelle Obama, Capricorn. Another political couple with a marriage that America loves to gossip about. Is our collective Leo Capricorn nosiness a result of the heavens? Kylie Jenner, Leo, and Timothy Chalamet, Capricorn. The stars are aligned for this power couple. Leo women like Kylie Jenner love attention, making her the perfect red carpet date. Meanwhile, Capricorn men like Timothy Chalamet love ambition, which beauty mogul Jenner has in spades. Jackie Kennedy Onassis, Leo, and Aristotle Onassis, Capricorn cusp. The pull was so strong for this duo that Jackie famously and scandalously jeopardized her relationship with Sister Lee, who dated the Greek shipping magnate before she did. Plus, hell hath no fury. If J.D. ever decides to cross his wife, she may find a strategic ally in pop culture's Queen of Revenge, Lily Allen. Capricorn Usha could find solace in Earth sign sister Taurus Lily Allen, say the Eduts. Lily's Venus in Aries knows how to strike back when scorned, a motivating example for Usha's restrained Venus in Capricorn.
Thank you.
You bet your life. Prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket entice enterprising nerds to make and lose fortunes by wagering on everything from politics to the weather. Zoe Bernard explains why they're unstoppable and only getting more powerful. Illustrations by Chantal Jachon. Opening illustration shows one of those old 8-ball toys with all kinds of questions surrounding it. Jack DeShane was doing serious volume on the Pope market. DeShane is 25 years old and, by his own account, knows next to nothing about the papal conclave. Yet in May 2025, as cardinals locked themselves inside the Sistine Chapel to decide who would inherit the throne of St. Peter after the death of Pope Francis, DeShane was on a website called Kalshi, buying and selling contracts worth some $30,000 on the various outcomes of who might win the papacy. These odds were driven less by Vatican intrigue than by straightforward mathematical calculation. For most of the conclave, the Chicago guy, the future Pope Leo XIV, was trading between like 1 and 5 cents, says DeShane. To predict the odds of various cardinals becoming pope, DeShane was not even using particularly fancy math, he tells me. This is math you can find on Wikipedia. DeShane had become so consumed by papal market making that he was falling behind on his studies at Princeton, where he was writing a thesis on game theory. Still, it seemed financially irresponsible to devote any time at all to classwork, given that DeShane could net some $10,000 on the Pope market alone in a single week. In a single year on Kalshi, DeShane estimates he's made $1.5 million. I met DeShane in the summer of 2025 at a Kalshi happy hour held at a dimly lit pub in Greenwich Village. The prediction market startup, newly flush with venture cash, had invited its most active users, or, as one organizer kept calling them, all the top dorks. To swap trading tips over beer and sliders. These were dressed-down guys in T-shirts, mostly in their early 20s, who were earning fortunes on a marketplace that until recently had existed in a legal gray zone. Many were making thousands a week speculating on highly specific fixations. Whether the temperature would tick up by a single degree in Colorado next weekend, who would win the Coney Island hot dog eating contest, the gender of celebrity babies. It may sound silly, but many of the hardcore nerds at the center of this movement saw something larger taking shape, an experiment in collective intelligence with the potential to upend not only Wall Street, but the inner workings of American democracy. Yet only one person there mentioned the dirty word that everyone else had so carefully avoided. A little guy in the corner, with especially large teeth, a thick Eastern European accent, and a few sparse hairs attempting to cloak his balding forehead, had been swirling a glass of ice and cryptically dodging my basic questions. For instance, what his name was. I'd been riffing about prediction markets with him when he leaned in close, his mouth full of cheeseburger. You're writing about this, but you have no idea what this meeting is, do you? What is it? I ask, leaning back to avoid his spittle. This, he said, taking in the barroom of traders, is just the latest Gamblers Anonymous meeting. Back in 2016, just about everyone on Wall Street wanted exposure to two things: Trump winning the election, and Brexit. At the time, Tariq Mansour, an MIT grad with a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow, was working as an analyst at Goldman Sachs and creating bundles of stock options that attempted to predict what might happen if Trump won or Brexit passed. This, as it turned out, was the financial equivalent of reading tea leaves through a Bloomberg terminal. The clumsiness of this exercise sparked Mansour to wonder, what if we create a financial market that prices questions about the future the same way you price a stock? Not long after, Mansour began sketching out an idea for a new kind of financial market, a cleaner, more direct version of the one he'd been simulating inside Goldman, It would do what markets at their best have always done, distill collective belief into a price. If it worked, Mansour reasoned that it stood to become the most consequential market ever built, because it would be concerned with questions that preoccupy everyone. The stock market prices corporate futures. Mansour wanted to build a market the price the future itself. The result was Kalshi, a company he launched in July 2021 with his co-founder, Brazilian-born fellow MIT grad and former ballerina Luana Lopez Lara, a marketplace that would make truth tradable. There was, however, one minor obstacle. The kind of market Kalshi wanted to build was illegal, at least according to the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So Mansour and Lopez Lara did what any enterprising startup founders might do. They sued the federal government. Thus began a slog of bureaucratic skirmishes that unfolded over the course of 3 years. The decisive blow came in October 2024, when Kalshi won the right to host an election market weeks before the nation's next presidential vote. This development, more than any other, vaulted prediction markets into the national conversation, bringing in more than $100 million in wagers. On Polymarket, another prediction market, and Kalshi's crypto-based competitor, traders put up a staggering $3.2 billion in wagers. Suddenly, what had seemed like a niche experiment was becoming a financial reality. Since then, the bets have kept on coming. Kalshi currently hosts more than 2,000 markets, ranging from headline events to the absurdly specific. The big idea, according to Mansour, is that these markets give us the ability to see the future more clearly. They are a mechanism for us to get a little bit smarter, he says. Imagine a world where, if we're debating on whether climate change is real, and you're screaming, "No, it's absolutely not real," and I'm screaming, "Climate change is 100% real, you're full of shit," there's a market where people have real money on the line saying that there's a 70% chance that next year is going to be hotter than this year. And we have this objective, unbiased, filtered source of truth for what the future holds. The reason these markets are so useful to society is because people have skin in the game. In many ways, these markets are nothing new. Americans have been betting on election outcomes as far back as the Lincoln era. In the 1930s, political wagers sometimes outpaced trading in stocks and bonds. Voting has always been a sort of gaming, like checkers or backgammon, Henry David Thoreau wrote in 1849, and betting naturally accompanies it. Markets also tend to be good at prediction. An election market created by three economists at the University of Iowa in 1988 beat the polls in at least three elections, and on Wall Street, futures markets have proved very good at forecasting. Considering this brief history, it's somewhat curious that prediction markets haven't gained wider traction. Other examples of futures markets, like the Hollywood Stock Exchange, launched in 1996 to let traders wager on box office results and predict it, a forecasting site founded in 2014, have repeatedly faced pushback from both institutions and regulators. But today's prediction market boom seems destined to last for two reasons. The first is that these markets have found unusually warm support in Washington under the second Trump administration, where they are treated like the hottest new civic innovation project. Next photo, risky rainmaker, Kalshi chief Tariq Mansour on stage at Web Summit 2021 in Portugal, sued to get prediction markets decriminalized in the U.S. Devin Nunes, the former congressman and current CEO of Trump Media and Technology Group, has described them as tools that empower everyday Americans to harness the wisdom of the crowd. Donald Trump Jr. serves as a special advisor to both Kalshi and Polymarket, and in October, Truth Social announced plans to launch a prediction market of its own called Truth Predict. The second reason is subtler. Prediction markets are gaining momentum in an era when experts have burned through their authority, institutional knowledge is almost universally scorned, and shared reality is splintering into an algorithmic hall of mirrors. The pollsters miss the polls, the networks can't agree on the facts, and Trump's government is backpedaling on 2 centuries' worth of scientific consensus. Perhaps these problems can be solved by putting a price on truth and turning it into a commodity. It's a very elegant, very free market-based approach, says Mansour. We're giving a financial incentive, rewarding people that have valuable information for society to bring into the marketplace. Already, these markets are viewed as a convincing barometer for truth. Saul Munn, a 22-year-old who studies philosophy at Berkeley and hosts forecasting events at universities, tells me that when he wants to know what's going on in the world, he is more likely to check the odds on Kalshi than watch CNN. The traders make a lot of money from being right, he says. One guy is incentivized to get clicks. The other guy is incentivized to make money. Never mind that prediction markets often rely on reporting from CNN to settle their bets. While boosters promise tidy yes or no wagers, in practice, traders sometimes spend days parsing ambiguous contracts in Kalshi's and Polymarket's Discord servers. Perhaps the most famous example of this was a bet on Polymarket that asked whether Volodymyr Zelensky would wear a suit by a certain date. When the Ukrainian president stepped out in a tailored-looking outfit, traders tore one another apart, debating the definition of the word suit. The market, which ultimately determined its outcome through what the company described as credible reporting, resolved to know, to no one's lasting satisfaction. Despite all the ambiguity, prediction markets' biggest backers, Silicon Valley venture capitalists, remain undeterred. It used to be that the medium was the message. In Silicon Valley, the line has been updated. The markets are the message, says one venture communications executive. That gospel has set off a frenzy. Since the election, so many people have started building prediction markets, says Arad Gishri, an investor based in Portugal. Some of these people are founders whose products didn't catch on, and so they pivoted to prediction. It's like dozens and dozens and dozens, like really a lot, and it's still happening. Gishri, too, has caught the bug. Earlier this year, he left his job as a venture capitalist to start his own prediction market called Lightcone Labs. According to prototypes I've seen and conversations I've had with dozens of traders and founders, the future of these markets looks something like this. Every news story will come with a trade button beside it. Podcasters will let listeners bet live as the hosts talk. NFL broadcast will flash odds on whether the next pass will be caught. Even reality dating shows will come with tickers predicting which couples are most likely to find love. In other words, every conviction will have a price. Boosters believe prediction markets could also double as a kind of idiosyncratic insurance for an increasingly unstable world. If you booked a beach vacation in Florida, for instance, and worried a hurricane might ruin it, you could hedge the risk by betting on the storm and recouping your losses on the weather market. If traditional insurers won't touch your California home, you could still place a sizable wager on the odds of a wildfire creeping into your neighborhood. This is going to be as big as equity markets, commodity markets, derivatives markets, says Tony Gamail, who has worked at both Kalshi and Polymarket. I think of them as opinion markets, and everybody has an opinion on something. The issue with both Kalshi and Polymarket, Gamail says, is that they generate their own markets, built around news cycles, elections, sporting events, and the occasional trader suggestion. Gamail plans to solve for this by, yes, building his own prediction market called the Clearing Company, which gives anyone the ability to create any kind of market they can imagine. According to Gemayel, the clearing company will be far better than any kind of futures markets that currently exist on Wall Street. Years ago, Gemayel met a guy in Seattle who got so good at modeling the weather that he now wins 95% of weather markets. To do so, he built a bespoke network of weather stations. Good luck to somebody at Citadel who wants to trade against this guy, because he will beat them, Gemayel says. This, to me, is the cool thing about prediction markets. Everyone has an area of deep expertise, something that they're way more interested in than somebody on Wall Street ever would be, and it's just really hard to compete against that. The prediction market boom has already cracked open a strange new world of opportunity that rewards obsession, precision, and niche expertise. In the months I reported this story, I met a stay-at-home mom in Alabama who studied meteorology in college and made $20,000 betting on 1- and 2-degree temperature swings in Denver. Today, she's known as Weather Shannon and works as an operations specialist for Kalshi. I met young men in their early 20s who quit their jobs as Wall Street quants to create market-making firms. Why would you work at Goldman when you can work at Kalshi? Ask a communications advisor who works with the company. This is the next generation of finance. But the most successful of all was a former poker player based in Las Vegas who tells me he's cleared $2.8 million this year betting on politics. His strategy involves watching C-SPAN 16 hours a day. We are entering a brave new world in which every headline, celebrity scandal, and twist of global politics can, will, be bought, sold, and wagered on. The downstream effects are already well on their way. In December, Kalshi struck a deal with CNN and CNBC to broadcast live tickers on air. Turning the news into a real-time market with the Kalshi logo attached. In January, the Golden Globes featured a polymarket integration, with announcers frequently mentioning the odds of various races as a ticker flashed on screen. Next photo, fortune teller. Feds raided the apartment of polymarket founder Shane Kaplan after his site correctly called the 2024 election. The cultural shift is so seismic that the venture firm Andreessen Horowitz believes it is poised to become the single organizing principle of the next era. Prediction is now the entire game, writes the firm's editor-at-large, Alex Danko, in a company blog post. It is the movement and meta-aesthetic that defines our main branch of society going forward. Prediction is as significant a concept as modernism and postmodernism. It's the defining reframe of our generation, and we'd better understand it. Their most zealous supporters envision prediction markets as a new framework for governing. In Silicon Valley, this idea is having a moment thanks to Robin Hanson, a prickly economist who years ago introduced the concept of futarchy, a system that would route government decisions through the cool logic of betting markets. In a paper that he first released in 2000, Hanson laid out a blueprint for a government that passes laws only when markets predict they will increase national welfare. The major problem of modern government, he argues, is that countries and democracies fail largely by not aggregating available information. One of the first people who mentions the idea of futarchy to me is a pseudonymous programmer in San Francisco who goes only by the name Prophet. He is a self-described super-anon crypto type. When he does make public appearances, he typically uses a voice distorter and wears a bronze cyborgian mask with two glowing blue eyes. Lately, he's slightly relaxed the anonymity. On the day we speak over the phone, he is not using a voice distorter. He sounds exactly how I expected him to, like a nerdy white guy in his late 20s or early 30s. About 3 years ago, Prophet launched a company called MetaDAO, which he describes as civilization's first futarchy. The company relies on markets to reach all of its key decisions, like whether it should seek outside investment. Like other Futarchy evangelists, Prophet believes that markets are a sleek, superior upgrade to the clunky machinery of government. This is not democracy, he says. It's a new thing. It's better. While democracy has been an improvement on other forms of governing, it's still pretty structurally flawed, Prophet continues. And markets don't have that problem, right? People that work in markets know all these intricate, fine-grained details about the companies they're analyzing because they can make money by having that information. Prophet's vision might sound fringe, but it's closer to the center of power than it appears. It's the same logic that animates one of the industry's rising stars, Shane Coplin, the curly-haired founder of Polymarket, who has retained a kind of industry bad boy allure ever since federal agents raided his apartment after Polymarket correctly called the presidential race in November 2024. No legal action was taken against Coplin or Polymarket. Futarchy is one of my favorite ideas that exist, Coplin tells me over a Zoom call last summer. It is a difficult sell, but the idea of using markets to aid decision-making in pursuit of optimizing for some final variable that is a metric that represents what people want or what's good for the body that's being governed is super exciting. When I ask if he thinks we are on a path to Futarchy becoming a tool of governance, he doesn't hesitate. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't think we were. It's seductive to see prediction markets as creating a gleaming world through pooled information and the cold clarity of bets. This vision posits that we all might be better off in a meritocratic republic of sharpshooters, placing elegant little wagers on the truths that will supposedly steer us toward a greater public good. The reality is more human and a lot stupider. These markets are kind of janky, John Oberlander, who trades on Kalshi, tells me. Aside from a bunch of markets that aren't that liquid, there are the usual teething pains of fast-growing startups. Glitchy sites, outages, weird edge case complaints that happen when you build something that was barely legal a few years ago. Then there are the complaints that cut directly against the high-minded mission prediction markets like to project. For all the talk of surfacing truth and harnessing collective intelligence, most of the volume on these sites comes from one of the oldest forms of gambling there is, sports betting. Nearly 90% of volume on prediction markets comes directly from sports contracts, and the sector has grown quickest in states that prohibit it, thanks to a convenient regulatory workaround. The cynical take is, wow, they came up with the word prediction markets to now offer gambling for the 50 states who didn't really sign up for this, says Oberlander. They have to do all sorts of theatrics to get the regulation and the tax treatment they want, but everyone who's invested in it can see what's happening here. When I ask Mansoor if Kalshi might just be a more polished spin on gambling, he says that he disagrees with the question's premise. We don't think it's gambling, he says. We just don't. And in the places where it really does look like gambling, what Kalshi provides is actually an ethical upgrade, according to Mansoor. On sports books, users bet against the house. On Kalshi, they bet against each other. Sure, Kalshi skims a transaction fee off the top of any trade, but we don't have any incentive for you to lose money, he says. Whether regulators buy that argument is another question. In late November, Kalshi was hit with a class action lawsuit accusing the company of running misleading, unlicensed sports gambling. Then again, what are financial markets if not nation-sized gambles dressed up as spreadsheets? For believers like Gamal, prediction markets aren't a deviation so much as a cleaner, smarter upgrade. Derivatives, in my mind, is just a fancy word for gambling, says Gamal. You know, a lot of what Wall Street is doing is a lot closer to betting than I think the average American realizes. the overlord's underdog, between Elon Musk and Sam Altman in their Silicon Valley battle royal, stands Mark Toberoff, a Malibu lawyer who'd rather be a movie producer. If only his name didn't send some studio brass into fits. Tom Doten sits down with the ultimate Hollywood litigator. Photographs by Ryan Pfluger. Opening photo shows Mark Toberoff sitting by a pool, dressed in a suit. In June 2024, the Hollywood attorney Mark Toberoff was in the fitness room of his Malibu home, barking into the phone that Elon Musk needed to withdraw his lawsuit against Sam Altman and OpenAI immediately. Toberoff had just begun advising Musk's legal team on the recommendation of Ari Emanuel, a mutual friend. OpenAI's lawyers had filed a motion to dismiss, on which a judge was going to hear arguments the following day. Toberoff wanted to file a new case, a bigger one, but if the judge ruled against Musk now, it could haunt what came next. From his yoga mat at 6 a.m, the litigator was emphatic, "Pull it now." Musk pulled it just hours before the hearing. Weeks later, Toberoff took over the case, and early that August, he filed a new complaint, this time in federal court, with 15 counts, including fraud and RICO statutes. Toberoff, a movie producer with credits on Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and Bad Boys, Ride or Die, wrote the new complaint like a movie logline. Elon Musk case against Sam Altman and OpenAI is a textbook tale of altruism versus greed, it reads. The perfidy and deceit are of Shakespearean proportions. The case was headed to trial in April and has become the tip of the spear in the bitter feud between Musk, the richest man in the world, and Altman, the man he entrusted with humanity's AI future. At stake is the fate of OpenAI, the now half-trillion-dollar company they co-founded a decade ago that has almost single-handedly kicked off the AI revolution. If Musk prevails, the court could undo the company's delicate restructuring of its for-profit arm, a decision that would jeopardize tens of billions in investor funding. Failing that, Musk is seeking one of the biggest financial judgments in history. Wrongful gains that reflect what he says his stake should be worth, given he was OpenAI's biggest early investor. Even if he loses on the merits, the trial itself will be a spectacle. Two billionaires facing off in front of an Oakland jury, airing all the bitterness and resentment that have been building for years. Musk is a veteran of jury testimonies. For Altman, this will be his first. That Toberoff would be in the middle of this legal battle surprises nearly everyone, no one more than him. He was not on a first-name basis with the big tech names at play, having spent most of his career as a creature of Hollywood. He met with Vanity Fair a few times last fall, twice at a family Italian restaurant in a Malibu shopping center, once over Zoom from his East 64th Street apartment, a Wassily Kandinsky print on the wall behind him. It was his first experience sitting for extended interviews about himself. Initially nervous, he eventually warmed to the project and began offering creative direction. "Would it be possible," he asked, "to do a photo shoot with a rented dog?" He joked it would make him more relatable. He's lived in Malibu for more than 25 years with his wife, Dahlia, an interior designer with whom he has four children. Their first house in Malibu burned down in a 2007 wildfire. His current one, in the coastal range above the Pacific Coast Highway, has expansive ocean views, and once the construction is finished, an infinity pool. He also has a place in the Hamptons, bought, he says, long before he could afford it. A slight figure with restless light blue eyes, Toberoff looks like a cross between Sam Rockwell and Ethan Coen, or perhaps an older version of Altman himself. I can just imagine the other side looking at me, looking me up and going, "Who is this guy?" Toberoff says. "But I've been underestimated before. In fact, that's my secret weapon." At early court appearances for the OpenAI case, Toberoff squared off against more than a dozen attorneys from Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, Morrison & Forster, and Deschere. Sometimes he had one associate. Sometimes he was alone. "I kind of like the imagery, you know," he says. OpenAI's attorneys say they're unimpressed. Mr. Musk's lawsuit continues to be noise without substance and is all part of his ongoing pattern of harassment. "And we look forward to demonstrating this at trial," OpenAI's lead counsel William Savitt says in a statement. He added that the company won't be distracted by these theatrics. If Silicon Valley doesn't know Toberoff, Hollywood certainly does. Depending on whom you ask, he's either a Robin Hood of forgotten creators and their heirs, or a scorched earth negotiator who holds projects hostage until studios pay him and his clients and give him a producer credit. Ask Toberoff what he does, and he'll say he's a producer first. He's made a living and a formidable IMDb page by helping writers and their heirs reclaim rights that were signed away decades ago. A provision of copyright law lets creators and their families take back what they gave to studios. Many don't even know they can reclaim them until he reaches out. Several people who've worked with him said he was known to pull out a list with the 100-plus properties his clients control a critical piece of. They include Predator, Friday the 13th, the Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter characters from The Silence of the Lambs, Bloodsport, Psycho, Porky's, Hellraiser, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Sometimes getting back the rights for his clients takes years. But rather than charge by the hour, he typically works on contingency. He commissions a portion of the rights fee if and when a project gets made. And if he can, he negotiates getting credited and paid as a producer. One studio executive describes the lunch meetings with Toberoff, where he'll produce the list and walk you through what he controls. "It's almost like going to a market. The guy opens his jacket with all these different watches. That's Mark with his IP. Several studio executives see him essentially as a copyright troll. An executive at an indie studio writes him off as an ambulance chaser. Others say they refuse to work with him because of his uncompromising style. Some won't even touch a property if they know he's involved. You make a deal, he agrees, and at the very end he changes his mind and goes on and on and on," one executive says. "It's bananas." Toberoff says he's merely enforcing rights Congress gave authors and their heirs in the Copyright Act. "This isn't ambulance chasing where someone's had an accident," he says. "No, somebody actually created this property." He's almost an exaggeration of relentlessness. In 2002, a barista at the Starbucks inside a Calabasas Barnes & Noble gave Toberoff's wife a 2-full cup of coffee that spilled on their 20-month-old son. Toberoff sued. The case was dismissed. He appealed. 8 years later, he won the right to a new trial. Barnes & Noble eventually settled. Emmanuel, whom he's known for several decades, and who was one of Toberoff's biggest supporters, says his results speak for themselves, though Toberoff can be a pain even for him. Sometimes he's the scorpion, "Oh, take me to the other side of the road," and then he bites you. There's nothing you can do about it. Toberoff doesn't comfortably fit the town's image of a lawyer. He has flashes of old Hollywood flair, calling a former boss a ganef, a studio chief an altercocker, and rattling off old Variety headlines as if they were obvious cultural touchstones. Toberoff set sail with Fantasy Island, but he also shows an appealing lack of polish that falls between candor and obliviousness. He's kind of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm character, one executive at a major studio says. Another recalled meeting with him at a West Side steakhouse to celebrate closing a big deal. He wanted to share the steak, which I thought was at the time slightly odd. Toberoff was raised in a lawyer's house. His father was a first-generation Jewish immigrant who grew up poor in Brooklyn and went on to become the king of medical malpractice law in New York, trying more than 300 cases. He was known for his brutal cross-examinations of expert witnesses, Toberoff says. He would reduce them into an oil slick. That approach carried over to the dinner table. Why didn't I take out the garbage? Why didn't I do this? He says. I grew up being cross-examined. He also grew up rich, lived in Westport, Connecticut, spent summers at the family house in France. His father gambled in Monte Carlo and drove a Lamborghini Countach well into his 70s. His mother was an intellectual, a German Jew whose family fled the Nazis, named him after Marc Chagall. She limited TV and comic books, but took Toberoff and his sister to the art house cinema every weekend to watch Bertolucci and Fellini. After initially resisting law school, Toberoff eventually applied to Columbia and had the misfortune of getting in. He found that he enjoyed studying copyright law, feeling it brought him closer to the arts his mom instilled. After passing the bar, he took a grueling job with storied New York law firm Kelly Dry & Warren. Once, after pulling an all-nighter, he got into an argument with a partner and was fired. He was giving me problems, Toberoff says. I don't do well with authority. Following a stint at an entertainment law firm, Toberoff realized he wanted to work in the movie industry. He wrote a letter to director Robert Altman, pitching himself for a job. The auteur took him on to handle business affairs in New York, but it was a disaster. When a screaming match nearly ended in a fistfight, the director was famously into drugs, booze, and gambling at the time. Toberoff quit. Still wanting to make movies, he went to the New York Public Library and researched producers' names, landing on Elliot Kastner, the prolific producer behind films like The Long Goodbye. Toberoff again wrote a letter. Dear Mr. Kastner, attached is my illustrious resume. Teach me how to make movies. I'll cut your legal bills in half. He got the job and spent the next few years as Kastner's gopher, picking him up at the airport, answering phones, and hanging around sets as 80s stars like Mickey Rourke and Lisa Bonet drifted through. It soon became clear why Kastner had answered his letter. The producer was drowning in lawsuits from people claiming he double-crossed them or owed them money. Next, he tried his hand at producing an indie film, Sons, with Jennifer Beals, and directed by her then-husband. To find a distributor, he went to Cannes during the film festival and paid kids to plaster the Croisette with posters at 4 a.m. Toberoff says the movie got distribution, barely. He then moved out to Los Angeles with Dahlia. One day, while walking on the treadmill and looking at the back of the Hollywood Reporter for a place to rent, he saw a listing from the son of a famous writer who was seeking a manager. Toberoff reached out. The son, a hippie who told the lawyer he used to drop acid but quit when he saw Neil Armstrong land on the moon, handed him a messy box of papers from his father. The old man, it turned out, had co-written The Marx Brothers' A Day at the Races and I Married a Witch, which influenced the TV series Bewitched. Leafing through the papers, Toberoff saw he'd also created Combat, a 1960s World War II TV series about GIs. In the box was a letter saying the writer was owed $327 related to something called separated rights. Scanning deeper, Toberoff discovered a provision in the Writers Guild collective bargaining agreement that says writers who create original TV series automatically retain certain rights, including film rights, that supersedes any other agreement. By pure coincidence, a week later, he read a story in Variety that Capital Cities ABC was making a combat movie starring Bruce Willis. He fired off a letter to the studio on newly created stationery, telling them they didn't have the theatrical film rights. Their lawyers responded with a longer letter, including the full contract, and pointing to the paragraph where his client's father had waived his separated rights. I've since learned that the hardest thing to get is the old contract, and a little information goes a long way with me, Tuberoff says. He told the lawyers that the paragraph showed a concerted effort by the studio to circumvent the WGA contract by pressuring his client's father to waive his separated rights in order to get the job, which violated the collective bargaining agreement. And besides, his client's father couldn't waive those rights anyway because he was only a beneficiary of the guild contract, not a party to it. The only parties were the studio and the guild, so only the guild could waive the rights, and the guild never had, which meant the separated rights reverted to his client. The studio's lawyers told him to come in for a meeting. Tuberoff put on a suit and tie and showed up at a Century City legal office where the studio offered to settle. Tuberoff countered, and when he saw in their eyes that they were going to take it, quickly added that he wanted to be a producer. They go, "Wait a minute, you're a lawyer, you can't be a producer." And I go, "No, it's the other way around. I had to go to law school." But anyone, it turns out, can be a producer. Combat never got made. Saving Private Ryan was greenlit around the same time, sinking the competing World War II project. But Tuberoff's career as a producer copyright attorney was born. He developed a system. He tracked the rights of old TV shows and films from eras when creators often retained rights. He'd cold call the writers of properties like My Favorite Martian or track down their heirs. He'd offer to examine their contracts, looking for angles. When he found an inn, he'd pitch revival projects around town. And when a studio said yes, take a cut. In Hollywood, no one had really done what he had done with copyright law. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.